Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
And this is the, I got to say, a story when it crossed the Bloomberg. Tim and I were like, yes, we have to do it. We know who we want to do it with.
We want Brad Stone to join us. He is senior executive editor of Global Tech here at Bloomberg News. He's the author of Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Also his earlier book on Amazon as well. Brad, good to have you with us. Okay, so we just heard from Bill Maloney about the stock reaction of One Medical up about 70% right now in the wake of that deal being announced earlier today. My big question for you is my doctor going to know how much ice cream I'm ordering from Whole Foods? Because I do go to One Medical.
Tim. Well, thanks. It's a good question. I think, you know, there are all sorts of HIPAA regulations here, and Amazon needs to be careful, obviously.
Okay, good. So secret's safe.
Yeah, I think so. But look, I mean, Amazon's been signaling its ambitions in healthcare for a very long time with PillPack in 2019. In 2020, when it started introducing devices like those Halo wristbands to help people monitor their activity and sleep. And then less visibly, you know, Andy Jassy in the private Amazon All Hands meetings always cites healthcare as a major avenue for growth. And he's been looking for that fourth pillar alongside Prime, AWS, and Marketplace. And I think he believes that healthcare is it.
What's the margins in healthcare overall and maybe the space that Amazon really wants to be in, Brad?
Right. Well, you know, Carol, my healthcare expertise consists of me going to the doctor, but I will say that One Medical, of which I was a member actually during the pandemic, you know, it's a very useful virtual service, a great kind of customer-facing technology stack, clinics in I think 18 states, but there are a bunch where I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. But it has been an unprofitable business, and you know, Tim, you mentioned the $18 per share buying price, and the stock is way up on the news. But you know, this was a business that was losing money. It's never made a profit, and the stock was trading around $10, well below the IPO price when it went public in 2020. So the business has struggled, but Amazon's comfortable in these very low margin businesses. So they obviously think that there are some synergies on the back end with AWS and what they're already doing with their healthcare initiatives where they can get this to profitability.
Does it turn into something like of a concern the way that Whole Foods has kind of been a concern for Amazon in the sense, Brad, that they didn't necessarily revolutionize the Whole Foods experience? It's something that you do touch on in your most recent book, because this is the biggest acquisition that Amazon ever made. The one that we're talking about today is the third largest after Whole Foods and MGM.
I mean, I think that might play to Amazon's benefit here, because you know when it bought Whole Foods in 2017, like the stock prices of other grocery chains cratered. There was a serious antitrust review, and you know, as you say, Tim, they haven't probably crushed that acquisition. The integration hasn't been as deep as some people expected. I think in a different environment, this deal might get a different look. I think it's probably likely to sail through. So, integrating these businesses is a challenge. Amazon probably needs to do better with Whole Foods. It integrated the warehouse robot business, Kiva, very well. Its record is a bit checked. So we'll have to see how they do on this one.
What do you make of, I think it's been, Brad, an interesting week. We had the story by Mark Gurman about Apple and their almost 60-page report and how they're kind of all in on healthcare. And then you've got Amazon continuing to, you know, wade deeper and deeper. It feels like, although I think our reporting said that this wasn't essentially a transformative deal for Amazon, but it does feel like big tech increasingly looking at healthcare, making moves there.
Well, look, these companies are giant. There are many fewer buckets of large potential growth opportunity. The global healthcare market is trillions of dollars. It's also an industry that, frankly, needs a little bit more technological disruption. The fact that, you know, it can be hard to book an appointment online with your primary care physician, the fact that it's difficult to go to, you know, to make a follow-up appointment, or to even, you know, the fact that prescriptions are sent manually to drugstores. There's opportunity there. There's also a lot of regulation and kind of institutional bureaucracy that sort of prevents this market from changing very quickly.
What would you imagine executives at Apple are thinking right now with this kind of move? Because as Carol mentioned, I mean, everybody in Silicon Valley wants in on healthcare. It's a fifth of our economy.
You know, I think probably the larger source of awkwardness is with Alphabet. Alphabet uses One Medical to extend an extra healthcare benefit to its employees. Mm-hmm. You know, there are plenty of companies now that are in that classic awkward situation of relying on a company that is now owned by a primary adversary. You know, Apple always innovates purely on the consumer side, often with devices. Right. I don't see this as a potential move Apple might make, but certainly it's one that Google's probably thinking about.
Awkward.
Yeah, you thought AWS was awkward, right? getting everyone off AWS if you're competing with Amazon.
Oh, my God. Hey, listen, 30 seconds. Should we be watching anybody else in terms of the big tech space, that might make a move here?
Well, I mean, I think this is probably more likely getting the folks like kind of CVS thinking about what is their route to the customer, what is their route into this primary care market, and then Amazon. You know, there are still pieces that they miss. Do they want to buy a health insurance company like CVS did with Aetna? Those are now the strategic moves to weigh.
Thank you. Brad Stone, Senior Executive Editor of Global Technology at Bloomberg News, author of several books, Everything When It Comes to Amazon, the Everything Store, and, of course, the latest, Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Thanks, of course, to Brad joining us from our San Francisco Bureau. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week, watching us on YouTube. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we do want to get to certainly another big topic that continues to be on our minds as we watch some of the cases. Of course, President Biden, we are expecting some comments because the president did test positive for COVID-19 today, is experiencing some mild symptoms. We've seen China's COVID-19 cases continue to hover around a two-month high. We are just watching this and the variant continuing to impact and evolve.
For the latest, we go to Dr. Eric Toner, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Toner joining us this afternoon on the phone from Baltimore. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, that is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Toner, good to have you with us this afternoon. I want to start with the president. He is twice vaccinated. He's twice boosted, but he's also 79 years old. According to the White House, he's been in contact with members of the White House by phone and will participate in Zoom meetings somewhere, a place that I should say many of us have been before when it comes to working with COVID. How should we read into his diagnosis?
Well, you know, it's not surprising. So many people are being reinfected with the Omicron variants, particularly the BA5 variant, which is now causing almost 80% of the infections in the U.S. So the vaccines and the boosting are great at preventing serious illness, that is hospitalizations and death, but they don't offer great protection against reinfection. So we're seeing this among many people and now the president.
Well, Dr. Toner, I got to say, I took two vaccines, two boosters, got COVID just recently after 26, 27 months of never getting COVID, although there's some question back in February of 2020. But nonetheless, you know, all boosted up, all vaccinated up, got a case, took Paxlovid, and got a second case within about a three-week period of time. This variant kind of freaks me out, and I do wonder where it evolves and where it takes us maybe in the fall when things start to get colder.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the evidence is not that strong that the cold weather makes a huge difference. Certainly being inside, which is more likely in the cold, may play a role. But these evolving variants just are finding a way to get around our defenses, not completely, but enough to cause reinfections. And, you know, and many people, although it's not a serious illness, it's certainly an uncomfortable illness for several days.
One thing that still gives me pause here when I think about the pandemic to endemic path that this seems to be taking, Dr. Toner, is that 300 to 400 people in the U.S. are still dying of this every single day. Do we know who these people are and if they're dying with COVID, if they're dying of COVID, if they're vaccinated, if they're boosted? Because that's a pretty scary number still.
Yeah. So most of the people have never been vaccinated. And most of the people are at greater risk because of age or because of underlying health conditions. That's not to say that somebody who has been vaccinated can't die from this disease, but it's rare. Most of the cases are people who've not been adequately protected.
So do we just get to a point where, I mean, coronaviruses, right, they've been around for a long time. We definitely have a lot more tools to deal with when it comes to COVID, less hospitalizations. I guess I'm just trying to, I was talking to somebody in the healthcare sector and it's pretty stressful and stressed me out, not only on COVID, but also then monkeypox. So how are we as a society, you know, figuring our way through it? Like, what's the next chapter of COVID in your view?
Well, I think we will continue to have waves of COVID that are, in general, are not as big as what we've seen in the past. I don't think this one will be as big as what we've seen in the past. And they will get gradually smaller, but I don't know how long that will take. And to some extent, it may depend on how quickly we get people in other countries vaccinated. So large parts of Africa, parts of Asia have never been vaccinated. And that's where some of these variants arise from. So we need to get global vaccination, really going well. But COVID's not going to go away. It's just going to diminish.
Is part of that diminishing getting like an Operation Warp Speed for the variants, Dr. Toner? It just seems like we're so many steps behind these variants when we think about adapting these vaccines. Wasn't that the promise of the mRNA platform?
Yeah, and the mRNA vaccines are doing a good job, but it's not instantaneous. You know, when a variant has been identified, it still takes months to get a vaccine ready. Months is better than years, but it still takes time.
Hey, if we may, just very quickly, 40 seconds, what do you make of companies like Amazon, Apple? Amazon doing a big deal in the tech space, healthcare space, Apple talking about having a big presence in healthcare. Just got 30 seconds here. Is this good or bad in your view?
Yeah, I don't know. I just saw those headlines today, and I don't know the details yet, so I don't know. It could be good, but I'm cautious.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Lots to still be known. Dr. Eric Toner, thank you so much. Senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. We appreciate his time on this Thursday.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Houston, we have a problem. Well, maybe not. Maybe more like Beyond Meat, we have a problem.
We do. We can't get the plant-based pepperoni to just, you know.
What's up with that?
Well, we're going to ask Dina Shanker all about it. She writes about it for Bloomberg News. She's a consumer reporter here, and she joins us on the phone from New York City. All right, Dina, what is the problem with Beyond Meat's pepperoni?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. And I think the better way to ask that question is, what isn't the problem with the pepperoni?
good point. What isn't the problem with Beyond Meat's pepperoni? We'll try this again.
So basically, they announced, Beyond and Yum Brands announced a big partnership in February 2021. They were going to put plant-based meat alternatives on menus at KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. Now, we're just about a year and a half after that announcement, and we don't have a permanent menu item on a single U.S. menu at any of those restaurants. The pepperoni has been sort of emblematic of the challenges that Beyond is having. None of this seems to be stemming from a lack of enthusiasm from Yum, but rather that Beyond simply cannot make product. They have just a lot of challenges with turning it into something real and sellable.
Is it just stuck on a plane between Pennsylvania and Europe, flying back and forth, waiting to be cut?
Watching movies with a blanket wrapped around.
Carol and I read this and we were both like, what? Why can't they cut this pepperoni in Pennsylvania?
That's a really good question. What the company told us is that the machine that they needed to slice the pepperoni was in Europe, and it made more sense just to bring the pepperoni to Europe for slicing. But, the expert that we spoke to here, who's a veteran food executive who worked with Tyson, Walmart, fast food companies, and he was like, you can find that machinery in the United States. Why would you bring it to Europe?
I mean, this is staggering. I just think, go back a few years, right? Beyond Meat, and they were just hooking up with everybody, and everybody was like all in on it. I mean, this was a stock back in July of 2019 that was above $234 a share. It's at 38 and change as we speak. How crucial is figuring out the pepperoni story and getting it right to really the growth story at Beyond?
You know, I think that this company had so much excitement and momentum behind it, and living up to that hype was going to be really difficult. But maybe they didn't, inside the company, internalize how much work it would take to really supply a company like Yum, and what it means to make a menu item for Pizza Hut. And we've seen this kind of problem with the rollout of their chicken product, which came really late compared to competitors. They told us in the last earnings that their jerky product that they did with Pepsi also had a lot of issues in terms of production. A hallmark of the Beyond Meat production is that they make their products in multiple plants that are situated in different places around the country. And in the case of pepperoni, it was actually different continents. So they just really haven't gotten their commercialization into the place it should be when they're working with partners that are this big.
How does it taste? Do we know how it tastes? Do you know how it tastes?
I couldn't tell you because it was only in under 70 Pizza Huts, and none of them were near me. The reason I actually started talking to so many people about the pepperoni was because I wanted to try it. And so I was waiting for there to be another test and for it to show up again, and it just never showed up. So I kept asking people, what's going on with the pepperoni? And when I talked to these former employees, it was like I just kept getting crazier and crazier stories about the problems that they were having.
Well, investors aren't so keen on Beyond Meat. As we said, stock's down 41% this year. Almost 42% of the outstanding shares of the float is being shorted as we speak. So that's a pretty negative tone. Hey, Dina, just got about 30 seconds left here. So is it just pepperoni's tricky? Is it that technically it's just tough to do, or is it that management, maybe they need somebody else in charge of the pepperoni and figuring it out just quickly?
Well, that's definitely something that I've been hearing when I talk to analysts and other people in the industry. Actually, they wonder, how long does Ethan Brown have and why hasn't he given over more control to his COO, his chief operating officer, who came in from Tyson, who is really supposed to right the ship, but that hasn't happened yet. So I don't know. We have to wait and see what the company decides to do about its leadership.
Yeah, pretty fascinating. What
check out this article online, because there's a pepperoni in a plane GIF that is just
that.
Awesome. And it's a great article too, Dina. Thanks for joining us.
It made my day, a little pepperoni in the driver's seat of the plane. All right, Dina Shankar, consumer reporter at Bloomberg News.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We do want to get to a very cool story that is from Bloomberg Business Week. It's also among the most read. And this is our cover story this week.
Chris Feliciano Arnold is the author of the story. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Business Week. Chris joining us on the phone this afternoon. Chris, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for having us. Love this story because I love all things drones. And I remember, what, almost 10 years ago, as you write, when Jeff Bezos was sitting with Charlie Rose the night before Prime Day, or I guess it was Cyber Monday, I should say, when he was unveiling Amazon's delivery drones. And they're not flying by our heads right now. What is the future of drones? What are NASA and the FAA doing right now to revolutionize air traffic control for what could be the drone era?
Yeah, it's interesting that in some respects, this future, we've been hearing about it for a long time, as you mentioned, almost 10 years now. And in some respects, the future is here. The advances in electric propulsion and battery technology have really made drones really exciting, what they're capable of in terms of their forms and capabilities. And yet, for a variety of reasons, that science fiction-like future we were told hasn't yet arrived. And one thing that I was surprised to find out is that one of the most complex tasks in making that future come to fruition isn't so much the hardware challenges, but more so the air traffic control challenge of managing what's amounting to an exponential increase in air traffic as regulators consider what it means to introduce potentially millions of new drones into the airspace.
I have to say, you want to get freaked out, Chris, you got to check this story, check it out on online, because it has that idea of, like, ultimately how many drones, I guess, are going to be up in the air, and just, you know, kind of how crowded our airspace.
The cover is literally a video.
It is. Yeah. And how crowded our airspace is going to get.
You've got pizza boxes and toilet paper flying at you, Carol.
Hot coffee, perhaps. That really kind of freaks me out. So enter NASA and the FAA. These are two areas of our government and our world that make sure people fly safely and make sure that when we shoot stuff up into space, it goes well. They've got to get it right. They're going to get it right, right?
Safety is the first and foremost concern for these federal agencies. And to put this in context, right now in the United States, there's about 200,000 planes and helicopters in active use. And at any point in time, even during peak hours, there's just over 5,000 aircraft in the air. Well, if we look forward to a world in which there's drone delivery, in which users can summon delivery drones on demand at any time of day or night for, you know, a burrito, a beer, coffee, pharmacy, medication, or whatnot, that is going to be an enormous increase in air traffic. And what has NASA and the FAA so concerned is, how are these drones, many of which are going to be flying below 400 feet in what has traditionally been uncontrolled airspace, how will they be sharing that airspace with planes that are operated by humans, while many of these drones will be operated semi-autonomously? And it creates a really confusing mix and a picture in which even the slightest error can cause a chain reaction that could put lives in jeopardy.
So, okay, this is where I'm like, wait a minute, it's going to be run by humans? Although they've done a good job with air traffic control, I guess, right? So should I feel good about that? Or would an algorithm that can figure it all out and make sure, I don't know, should I trust an algorithm more?
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing, is that, in fact, this is going to be sort of an intersection for the time being of human air traffic control and computer algorithmic air traffic control. So traditionally, when we think about the task of an air traffic controller, it's all about being able to pay close attention to that work for long stretches of time, being able to act with stability under pressure. Well, that's one thing to manage that in the context of a few thousand aircraft. But when we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these operations per day, that's obviously a greater scale than any number of human air traffic controllers can manage. Enter the algorithms. And yet, although the software and big data is incredibly powerful, there's all sorts of other variables to consider, including connectivity with other devices. How are these devices connecting with each other? How are they connecting with the ground? What happens if a network goes out? What happens if a nefarious actor tries to interfere with the
5G
network?
5G interference, or what is it that's supposed to interfere with, 5G. Like planes, right?
Yeah, so there's incredible number of factors that can interfere, not to mention just the everyday things like bird strikes or strange weather or other unpredictable events. And so it's the sort of thing that algorithms are certainly going to play a huge role, and wireless connectivity is going to play a huge role in making sure that these objects aren't colliding. But we're introducing so many new types of aircraft for so many purposes.
Right.
That there's so many potential unintended consequences.
Okay.
And that's what I think that the FAA and NASA are really trying to get ahead of.
Well, that's where I want to end in the last minute that we have with you, are unintended consequences of this technology. We think about, you know, crashes, and those would be terrible. But what about the idea that drones could be invading our personal space and could be worries about civil liberties, or they could be used to traffic drugs or drop weapons in places that where there shouldn't be weapons?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen this recently, even with that drone that was mysteriously flying over Yankee Stadium the other night, that we need to be able to know, like, where are these aircraft and what are they doing? Where ought they be able to fly?
Right.
When? How low? How loud? What sort of data should they be able to collect, whether it's video or audio? How long should that data be able to be stored? There's innumerable questions that need to be right. answered. And I think one of the big questions of this story is, how fast are regulators willing to move versus how fast are these companies wanting to move?
Chris, 15 seconds. After doing this story, do you feel like, I mean, drones are coming, get ready for it, everybody, and we'll do it safely? We can do this real quickly.
I think they will be here sooner than we think. And I think that for all of our sake, I hope that it does. We can do so safely.
Fingers crossed. All right. Chris Feliciano Arnold, contributor of Bloomberg Business Week. This is the cover story of the new issue, out already on newsstands, online, and always on the Bloomberg. We're checking into Snap. Big sell-off in the after hours following no guidance. Looking forward.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it, everybody. Just about 10 and a half minutes left of today's trading session, and we are pretty much at our best levels of the session. Yep, we are. When it comes to the equity trade, you heard Charlie breaking down the numbers, and really tech outperformance once again with the NASDAQ up 1.25%.
Let's get into it with Marcy McGregor. She's Senior Investment Strategist and Managing Director, Chief Investment Office of Merrill and Bank of America Private Bank. Marcy, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us. I want to get an idea of really how you're looking at the market, because earlier this week we had this back and forth whether or not we've reached capitulation. Bank of America was saying one thing. We saw Bernstein yesterday come out and say another thing. Where do you fall personally?
Yeah, there's so many cross currents right now. I think in the very near term, we're seeing this relief rally within a bear market for that reason. Sentiment is so bearish. And, you know, cash positions are really high. We've seen institutional investors already reposition and get quite defensive. So I think we're seeing a little bit of relief from the markets that we've seen recently. But in the bigger picture, I think really what the market needs is evidence that inflation has peaked. And ultimately, I think we need to get through this period, which I think is going to be an earnings reset where expectations get reset lower. And that's where I think markets can actually get set in a more meaningfully positive direction for the longer term.
So, Marcy, what I wonder is, what are the meetings you guys are having in your offices when it says to, all right, folks, we're watching the data points. We need to think about, you know, markets looking ahead to kind of what's next, not what is. So I'm just wondering, as you, the calculus of when you think that might be and when you might position or think about positioning for maybe a much more certainty when it comes to economic growth.
Yeah, we're all looking for that certainty. So recently, most recently, we've actually lowered risk on behalf of our clients in our portfolios because we do think this volatility is going to continue. I think it's a time to tilt towards higher quality investments, to kind of muddle through this period. When I look ahead, unfortunately, this earnings reset isn't going to be like a Band-Aid getting ripped off. I think it's going to take some time, possibly over the coming months. We've already seen economic growth really moderating. The market's clearly looking way ahead. So I think, unfortunately, we're probably in for this choppiness over the next few months.
Right.
The earnings reset is the real milestone I'm looking for.
You keep saying earnings reset, but I do wonder about, if I look at the year already, we're already halfway through. I mean, first quarter was a bummer in a big way in so many different asset classes. Over the past month, we've seen, Arkriti Gupta talked about it earlier, of more stocks hitting, I think it was 50-week highs. So there's much more breadth in the market. And if you look at those major industry groups in the S&P 500, many of them, most of them, are higher for the last month overall. So we've seen a rotation, a rethink among investors. You think that's just kind of a mind fake, if you will, or a head fake?
I think it's just a little bit of a relief rally right now. And without a doubt, market breadth has improved. And I like what I'm seeing in some of these market internals. Seasonality of July is on our side right now as investors. But we haven't seen consensus estimates for earnings, especially for 2023, come down. I still think they're too optimistic. We're not looking for a huge decline in earnings. I actually think it'll be much milder than we've seen in past recessions or even in past recessionary-like periods. But what we're seeing as an early indicator is earnings revision ratios are just starting to deteriorate. The U.S. among global regions is now the lowest ratio in the world, and we have two downgrades for every upgrade right now on U.S. equities. So I think there's a little bit more to this story to go.
In comparison to like Europe or something? Does that make sense to you?
I thought that the ratio, it had been above one for Europe and Japan, which struck me as a little strange. I totally agree, because I actually think macro-wise, Europe is the weakest link in the global economy, of course, given their energy crisis and the slowdown in growth they're facing there. So it is a bit surprising, but I think earnings revisions are a good kind of early indicator about when it's time to get more positive. I just don't think we've seen a trough yet.
Okay, well, let's shift the conversation and talk a little bit about where you're looking for areas of growth and where you're bullish. I know you're overweight on energy, financials, healthcare, real estate, and utilities. I want to start with energy. Given that we've seen a little bit of a pullback within oil prices lately, why do you think energy still has room to run higher?
Yeah, so I think energy, I'm actually viewing this pullback as a healthy sign for this sector. Energy and banks are the only two regions that are seeing upward revisions. And big picture, there's no quick fix for the structural supply-demand issues that are taking place globally in the energy markets. And in light of course, the geopolitics in Europe, I think North American energy is going to be part of the long-term solution. Also, if you look back at the 1970s, the last kind of inflationary period we saw of significance, energy as a sector doubled in market cap. So I like energy for exposure, even though it's had a little bit of a reset recently.
Even though we know that longer term, we're going to have to shift from traditional energy, you know, fossil fuel to alternative, you're saying that there's still more room to run for traditional?
I think that that's the difference of time horizon, right? I think of traditional energy for the next year or two, but undoubtedly, if we look out a decade from now, it's going to be all about a greener, cleaner world. But that's the difference in time horizon for us as investors.
You like real estate. I'm kind of confused about home builders. They're up about 2.7% today, despite D.R. Horton cutting its home sales forecast, a slowdown hitting builders. We see mortgage rates spiking. What kind of real estate do you like?
So I think there's this tug of war going on right now in the housing market, for example. Obviously, affordability has become really challenged, but we estimate there's a deficit of homes in the U.S. by 3 to 4 million homes because home building has lagged so much since the global financial crisis. So I think that tug of war is going to play out. I like the broad sector, though, for inflation positioning, right? We don't think inflation is going to turn significantly lower in the immediate future. So that's how I like to position our clients for higher inflation that's here to stay for a bit.
All right. Well, covered a lot of ground. Thank you. Great to check in with Marcy McGregor. She is Senior Investment Strategist and Managing Director of the Chief Investment Office of Merrill and Bank of America Private Bank, joining us on the phone in New York City.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.